Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, community-powered radio, on the air serving Portland since 1968. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Views, reviews, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, anti-colonial, and LGBTQ-friendly point of view. Today on our show, we're going to talk about a lot of big picture stuff with an emphasis on the labor market, supply chain issues, and what's up with the Progressive Caucus of the Democratic Party. Along the way, we'll take a breather for a book review, a spot of poetry, and some protest music, old and new, by some of your favorite artists. But first, we have a very scary event coming up, and I don't mean Halloween. Rather, it's the UN-sponsored climate summit known as COP26. So far, world leaders and their corporate sponsors have not taken the kind of bold action we need to prevent climate catastrophe. Activists around the world are mobilizing to pressure global leaders to do the right thing. The stakes could not be higher. COP26 PDX is part of the Global COP26 Coalition. To see a list of their demands, you can visit COP26coalition.org/demands. Locally, a series of actions are being planned, including a rally on Saturday, November 6th. A calendar of the COP26 PDX events will be available at orclimatehub.org. You can also visit Instagram at COP26_PDX for daily action updates. We'll post all the links you need on our KBOO webpage to keep you connected. Be active, get involved. It's your world we're talking about. One last thing before we get our show rolling this morning. KBOO is on the air because of support from listeners like you. If you did not get a chance to contribute during our fall drive and you have the resources to spare, you can still go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button. And thanks to everyone who has given generously to keep community radio alive in Portland. On our show today, Larry Bolden provides our literary break with his review of Elizabeth Strout's latest novel, Oh, William. Joe Clement speaks with Eric Dernbach about labor power in the current political economy in part two of a two-part interview. And I will conclude the show with a reading from a recent article by labor organizer and scholar Kim Moody about the breakdown of supply chains. To begin our show, Bill Resnick speaks with activist and leftist thinker Norman Solomon about prospects for the Progressive Caucus of the Democratic Party to effectively address the multiple crises we are facing. Bill?
Hi, Norman Solomon. Welcome again to KBOO.
Hey, thanks very much. Good to be with you.
Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Norman Solomon, a KBOO alumnus, went on to become an author of 12 books. He's a syndicated columnist, also an activist and movement builder. He founded the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's affiliated with FAIR, Fairness, Accuracy, and Recording, and founded the organization Roots Action that mobilizes, demonstrates, educates, writes letters, and many other things behind policies that actually address the immense economic, social, racial, and environmental problems facing our country. Norman Solomon ran for Congress in 2012, narrowly lost in the open primary. He was a Bernie Sanders delegate at both the last two Democratic National Conventions and coordinated the Independent Bernie Delegates Network in his efforts to win the nomination in 2016 to defeat Hillary Clinton. Unfortunately, Sanders did not. And throughout his call, he wrote articles and op-eds. Indeed, he has one in the magazine, The Nation, with Daniel Ellsberg. The title is To Avoid Armageddon, Don't Modernize Missiles, Eliminate Them. So, Norman, we're seeing a struggle for the soul of the Democratic Party. The old guard is being challenged, and newbies, progressives, are not afraid to discuss discuss nationalization, for example, of the energy industry. That's one example. Also, strong support for labor unions, Black Lives Matter, meaningful democratization of decision-making across the society, and also deep cuts in the military budget. Norman Solomon, tell us about the rise of the Progressive Caucus. Then we can get to Build Back Better and the other sweeping Biden administration initiatives now being cut back, but still important. First, Norman, the Progressive Caucus.
Well, Bill, it's good to be with you, and I really appreciate that for so many years on the Old Mole, you've been providing perspectives and information to KBOO listeners. If you go back, say, a dozen years, the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives was an effort, but not a very effective effort, to galvanize the support of progressives inside the Democratic Party, inside Congress. And the leadership was, well, not the greatest. It was making a lot of assertions of power, but when push came to shove, it would really fold. And that certainly happened on health care during the very beginning of the Obama administration. You had, for instance, a promise from the top of the Progressive Caucus that they would not vote on the floor for any measure that didn't include at least a public option, which wasn't all the way to single-payer Medicare for all, but would have a sort of nonprofit government health care insurance plan made available in the mix of these exchanges that states would provide. But then when push came to shove, the leadership of the Progressive Caucus back then in 2009 basically collapsed its claim of being stalwart and just gave in. So the long story short, Bill, I think we could say that for many years, the Progressive Caucus in Congress developed a reputation for, hey, we will talk big, but we can be rolled. We can really fold. That has, to a large extent, changed. And let's acknowledge that progressives in Congress, including the Squad, people like Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, now Jamal Bowman, AOC, they're in a tough spot. And it's going to be difficult in the days ahead to navigate the situation where you have Senators Sinema and Manchin chipping away at what needs to be a very large bill to revitalize public investment from the U.S. government, pulled down from $6 trillion down as we speak to about $2 trillion in the intra-Congress negotiations. But that said, to get back to your question, the Congressional Progressive Caucus has taken to this moment a much stronger position, and it's given progressives more power in Congress as a result.
Yeah, my sense was that the big difference, in fact, the moment that the Progressive Caucus began to really enlarge and be able to assert power, it's with the Bernie Sanders campaign showing that such a great number of people within the party, and particularly in many, many districts, support really progressive legislation. And I think noting that there was an electoral surge by many progressives, and the outcome now is obvious.
That's been important. And when you can show that you can win elections from the grassroots, that's crucial. You know, when Cori Bush in St. Louis area ousted a longtime sort of mushy liberal, that was important. When Jamal Bowman ousted Elliot Engel in the Bronx area and beyond in New York City, that was important as well. It's really sent a message that progressives can win elections. We usually don't if it's very strong progressives, but it can happen. And it can challenge people who are in Congress, have been there a while. Maybe they answer to the label liberal. Maybe they call themselves progressive. And so that gives more leverage. I should say that when we're talking about Oregon, the worst member of Congress who's a Democrat is Kurt Schrader. And I know that many of our listeners live in Schrader's district. If you go down, I believe, to Clackamas County and out towards the coast, Kurt Schrader's a terrible corporate Democrat. He's been one of the worst in the House. And these are the kind of people who have to be defeated in primaries by genuine progressives who can run strong campaigns, not impulse campaigns like you grab a candy bar on the way out of the checkout stand at the supermarket, but well-planned campaigns that take literally years, or at least a full year, to plan and execute before the election. And that ability of progressives to do serious electoral work, whether we're talking about local races, state legislature, Multnomah County, whatever it might be, this is very important because it is a building block to exerting pressure at all levels of government for progressive purposes.
Yeah, one thing that I want to add, though, and I know you agree with, one of the best members of Congress also comes from Oregon, Jeff Merkley. That brings us to the great sweep of Biden's initiatives. They've been whittled down, less money, but not to nothing. It seems to me that the Biden administration's proposals, including especially the climate action proposals, as a totality, they can be seen as an agenda for action, if not in this Congress, but soon. What's your sense?
Well, we have some awful members of Congress who have a D after their name, Joe Manchin from West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, both senators being notorious ones. We also have a progressive push, and we have some members of Congress that will blow with the wind. And as you say, I think the Green New Deal, which is still largely aspirational under that title, has been very important, and it came from the grassroots. As usual, the most important drastic reforms and paradigm-changing proposals come from the grassroots. They come from states. They come from localities where people raise hell with their elected representatives and organize outside the electoral system as well as inside of it to make change. And there was a big moment right after AOC was elected, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and we're talking now close to 3 years ago, when there was a sit-in by the Sunrise Movement in Nancy Pelosi's office, the Speaker of the House in D.C., and AOC went to that sit-in to give verbal support, and that was symbolically important, and politics is in part symbols, and it helped put on the agenda and the discourse, and people such as Bernie Sanders in Congress and people whose names we don't know around this country fought to make sure that the concept of a Green New Deal would be put forward. I know it came from the grassroots. I can mention that in 2010, 2 years before my congressional campaign ended in the primary election, I was co-chair of a Green New Deal commission that was totally not part of any governmental entity, but in Northern California, in Marin and Sonoma counties, we held a bunch of independent hearings, 8 or 10 of them, about what we called a Green New Deal. We weren't the first, but we were part of that process. And so my point, Bill, is that when people bring up ideas, commitments, principles, aspirations, determination that are not taken seriously in Washington, D.C., in official circles, we might be blown off for a long time, but that's how change happens.
My sense is, Norman, that though the early initiatives, Build Better Back, family job program, family support programs, all of them are being little. On the other side, though, and the real test of the Biden administration is what they do with the existing budgets of the Energy Department, of the military, of Medicare and Medicaid, how they direct those departments. The Energy Department, for example, has huge sums of money, huge $20-30 billion, whatever it is, that they invest in research, and they can do research into carbon sequestration, or they can do research into small-scale experiments, and not just experiments now. All over the country, municipalities are moving into providing energy, and there's a large sector of public utilities. They can really support those programs. And across the board, in terms of community college tuition help and so many other programs, even the mutilated public assistance program can, and childcare programs can be, in fact, made far more effective. What do you see as, Norman, the American Prospect did that series on what Biden could do even without legislation. It seems to me that we have to keep pushing, and the progressive caucus can't push them, no matter how far, whatever compromises have to be made to, in fact, transform policy of some of the existing agencies?
Well, in terms of the Department of Energy, I mean, it's a notorious agency for people paying attention. It's responsible for the nuclear weapons production complex and has done terrible things from Hanford, of course, on the Columbia River to many other facilities. My understanding, and I'm not an expert of it, but carbon sequestration is, you know, a scam, a waste of money. It sounded good a few years ago. What we really need to do is cut back on methane and especially, of course, fossil fuels. It has to be drastic. And again, we have Joe Manchin in the Senate, unfortunately, a senator from coal, who's really been holding up progress. There has, as you allude to, been a lot of conceptual step forwards from Democrats in Congress who are feeling the pressure. I mean, the Republican Party is a complete and utter disaster. There's not one good thing you can say about it. It has become in many ways neo-fascistic, and the Democrats have been overall moving in a good direction. If, however, for instance, as you said, military budget is one of the tests for the Biden administration, it has completely failed. It has completely flunked. It has continued to raise the military budget. I don't say defense budget, certainly not lowercase d defense. Biden came in asking for a 1.6 increase in an already tremendously bloated, huge military budget, and Democrats pretty much doubled that increase amount, and Republicans were pushing it, and Democrats also went with it. So this is a disaster, the military-industrial complex. Well, you go to Portland or Salem or Vancouver or any cities in the Northwest or around the country, and I probably don't need to tell listeners who are in Portland or elsewhere what is happening to urban areas and rural areas, the lack of infrastructure. I do think that Biden, especially early on with the $6 billion, even with $6 trillion over 10 years, a yearly ratio, half of military spending, but the 10-year, $6 trillion overall bill that's been, as you said, whittled down. This is very important. It would have been extremely valuable at $6 trillion, very valuable at $3.5. We're going to take what we can get, so to speak. But this is inadequate, but it's a step, an important step in public investment in a good direction.
Norman, to conclude, you're a writer, an activist. You get into the struggles in Congress. Right now, Roots Action that you founded is fighting to stop the confirmation of Rahm Emanuel to be ambassador to Japan. What's the story?
It's an important story, and it deserves more attention than it has been getting overall. The fact is that Rahm Emanuel is one of the most corporate, viciously corporate operatives in the Democratic Party. He was head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. He was in Congress for a few years. He was mayor of Chicago for 8 years, in which time he oversaw shutting 50 public schools, mostly in racially minority neighborhoods, shut a dozen or so, as I recall, mental health facilities. He was running an administration that covered up the police murder of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, a young African-American man. Notoriously, that administration suppressed the video showing that police murder for 13 months until after Rahm Emanuel was reelected at a very close race. And Rahm Emanuel has now been nominated by President Biden to be the U.S. ambassador to Japan, which is the third largest economy on the planet. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee just a couple of weeks ago held its hearing with Rahm Emanuel whether to approve his nomination to be ambassador to Japan, and only one senator out of a couple of dozen on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee had the gumption and really the courage to speak directly with tough questions to Rahm Emanuel about his administration as mayor in Chicago, overseeing the cover-up of the police murder of Laquan McDonald. And that senator was Oregon's Jeff Merkley. And the takeaway is first that Merkley was very strong and really brave politically to do that. And you had other people on that Senate Foreign Relations Committee who took a dive. As a matter of fact, Ed Markey from Massachusetts didn't even show up. Cory Booker from New Jersey didn't even show up. These were people who voted for the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act last year, but they didn't even show up because they didn't want to be in the uncomfortable position of either questioning in any intelligent, tough way Rahm Emanuel, or basically showing their silence by being there and not being willing to confront. So I guess what I would emphasize at this point is that any day now, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is going to vote on the nomination, and then the vote will go to the full Senate floor. And I would urge people to contact Senator Jeff Merkley, if you live in Oregon, and contact via email or telephone Jeff Merkley's office. Praise him for being a senator willing to ask tough questions of Rahm Emanuel, and urge him to announce that he's going to vote no on the nomination.
Norman Solomon, we're out of time. Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
You too. Thanks, Bill.
So long.
That music was from Inner City Blues by Marvin Gaye, his classic lament about the systemic blight of Black lives. Before that, Bill Resnick was in conversation with activist and writer Norman Solomon about political prospects for the growing progressive wing of the Democratic Party. According to book mole Larry Bolden, O William, the title of Elizabeth Strout's new novel, could just as well have been Oh, Elizabeth. In her latest, featuring Lucy Barton and others of her past characters, Strout once again demonstrates how ordinary events in ordinary people's lives are always complex and quite extraordinary. She delves into the personal in ways that few authors can manage with such startling insights. Today, I will be reading Larry's review for him. Believe me, I am giving nothing away by beginning my remarks by quoting the last page of Elizabeth Strout's new novel, Oh, William. And then I thought, Oh, William. But when I think, Oh, William, don't I mean, Oh, Lucy, too? Don't I mean, Oh, everyone? Oh, dear everybody in this whole wide world, we do not know anybody. Not even ourselves. Except a little tiny, tiny bit we do. But we are all mythologies, mysterious. We are all mysteries, is what I mean. This may be the only thing in the world I know to be true. End quote. Strout, in her unique way, again reminds us that there are no ordinary people, that everyone is extraordinary, and that the simplest of day-to-day events is filled with mystery. As she does in each of her novels, Strout revisits old characters. This time, it is Lucy Barton who reappears. Like Strout, Lucy Barton is an author. Her most recent husband, David, has died, leaving her buried in grief. And she decides to tell us a few things about her first husband, William, with whom she has remained good friends after their divorce. They have two adult daughters together, and the two daughters have a half-sister from William's last marriage. William has been married three times, Lucy, Joanne, and Estelle. William has been having terrifying dreams, and he finds it quite natural to confide in Lucy regarding those dreams. He wonders if the dreams have simply to do with getting older. Lucy answers him. "Maybe," I said, but I was not sure this was the reason. William has always been a mystery to me, and to our girls as well. I said, tentatively, "Do you want to see anyone to talk about them?" End quote. Strout's writing is so simplistic, so flat, and yet her readers understand they are being given a very wise view of the world. At times, her writing seems almost like the awkward journal jottings of a high schooler. And yet, there seem to be profound insights about marriage, about raising children, about respecting old relationships, and getting beyond petty jealousy. Both William and Lucy have had sad, lonely childhoods and few warm feelings about their mothers. Here's Lucy again. "This is about my own mother. I have written about her, and I really do not care to write anything else about her. But I understand one might need to know a few things for this story. The few things would be this. I have no memory of my mother ever touching any of her children except in violence. I do not remember that she ever said, 'I love you, Lucy.'" End quote. The rather complicated and often humorous plot of this novel is, I think, much less important than Lucy's asides. Asides about choice and loneliness and not being able to let go of past hurts. As Lucy says, "People are lonely is my point here. Many people can't say to those they know well what it is they feel they might want to say." End quote. The only other writer I can think of who is as skillful in uncovering the extraordinary in ordinary lives is Alice Munro. And like Munro, who writes almost exclusively short stories, Strout makes her points in passing, in throw-off comments. Her insights cannot be easily summed up, her messages not easily articulated. I will leave you with this heart-rending quote from Lucy. "There have been times, and I mean recently, when I feel the curtain of my childhood descend around me once again, a terrible enclosure, a quiet horror. This is the feeling, and it was with me my entire childhood, and it came back to me with a whoosh the other day. To remember so quietly yet vividly, to have it represented to me in this way, the sense of doom I grew up with, knowing I could never leave that house, except to go to school, which meant the world to me, even though I had no friends there, but I was out of the house. To have this come back to me presented a domain of dull and terrifying dreariness to me. There was no escape. When I was young, there was no escape, is what I'm saying." End quote. Oh, Elizabeth, you genius storyteller, please keep writing. I've been talking to you about Elizabeth Strout's 2021 novel, Oh, William. This is Patricia Kullberg, reading for Book Mole, Larry Bolden, and for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Taller than me, and partly it's the boots, but mostly it's my chi, and I'm becoming transfixed with nature and my part in it, which I believe just signifies I'm finally waking up. And that moth outside my kitchen door, she's bonkers for that bear pulp, flying round in circles, bashing her in her exhaust, stalling out in the woods, she navigates fine by the moon, but get her around a light bulb and she's and she is trying to give up.
That was a clip from Ani DiFranco's song called Evolve, about her struggle to resist the multiple crises that we are currently facing. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 on your radio dial. Next up, we have Joe Clement in conversation with labor movement researcher, activist, and educator Eric Dernbach. They conclude their conversation from last week with a dive into the rubber meets the road realities of workers' power on the job. Joe concludes his interview with a short but rousing reading of a poem. Here's Joe.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Last week, Eric Dernbach and I talked about the uptick in quit waves across America and the different factors that are giving workers leverage in the economy. And we're talking about how we need to be focusing that energy into organizing behind the leverage that that represents. In this second half, we really get down to the rubber meets the road reality of union power, worker power, control of labor. And it's so important, I think, for workers to realize how much power we have. Kim Moody's piece today that Patricia Kohlberg is talking about is all about how the economy is very fragile and depends on our labor working in concert much more than it ever did before. And where we left off, we were talking about kind of the solidarity union model and how to educate workers on how to take power in their workplaces amongst themselves, and was then turning to ask about the emergency workplace organizing committee and how it has been trying to fill the gap of worker political education is just an example of the kind of educating that we need to be doing. What is EWOC doing to teach around these concepts and skills?
So the process is, I mean, there's a form on the website. You know, if a worker encounters, they hear about it, or they know somebody who's in it or something like that, they fill out the form. Then they have an intake conversation with a volunteer organizer to find out the basics. You know, where do you work? What's going on? What are the working conditions? What are the issues? And then it kind of goes into the database, and then a more advanced organizer will contact them for additional conversations. And I have been one of those organizers. And I joined the project because I was intrigued about this effort to just reach more workers that wanted help. And so I've taken, you know, I think at this point, 70 cases, you know, where I reach out to workers and we have conversations. Now, honestly, like half of them I never hear back from because workers change their mind or they quit or they don't want to do it. But I get into conversations with workers and we come up with an organizing plan. And EWOC on its website has kind of like the five steps of organizing basics. And these are very similar that you will find with IWW training or Labor Notes training or Jane McAlevey's strike training or other basic trainings. And that is start talking to coworkers and finding out what people's issues are, form an organizing committee. Ideally, it's something like 10% of the workforce. So if you work at a workplace with 100 workers, ideally your committee would have 10 workers. That committee continues to talk with folks. You map the workplace, you know, literally keep a spreadsheet. Who talks with whom? Who are workplace leaders? What are folks' issues? Boil down the list of issues to like 3 to 5 that folks care about the most and are willing to take action on. And then a typical action, it doesn't have to be this way, but a typical action is that you will get a majority of workers at the workplace to sign a petition to the boss. It could be friendly language, if you want, saying we need these things, list the things that you need, and then do a march on the boss, where you have a committee, bring it to the boss's office, give it to them, read it to them, and say we expect a reply. It could look a bunch of ways. Some folks like it more confrontational. Some folks, you know, want to have a friendly chat. But strength in numbers matters. Having a majority matters. You're more likely to win. There's less likely to be retaliation. Oftentimes people will win. I think it's really interesting. EWOC now has hundreds of campaigns. A lot of them are still in progress. And, you know, I think we're collecting data on, you know, how many have started, how many have won something, what are the steps that they went through. And I suspect that, you know, if workers can form an organizing committee, draw up their demands and take some action, that they will win improvements. So then you take stock, see where you're at, and then organize for more. You know, organizing kind of never ends. It's the ongoing class war. But that is valid union organizing. You don't have a written contract, but you have organized and you have won improvements, and the boss has ceded power and you have claimed some power. So that is the process, and it's not without risk. So I would not recommend that folks embark on a strike tomorrow. This needs to be well thought out and planned. And that is the process at EWOC, and I know also at IWW, where we will work with folks to form this plan over time, do this organizing, take the notes, come up with a strategy, and then take action when workers are ready.
This is so important to emphasize, I think, in this time when strikes are getting such a focus on the meaning of worker power. And of course they are, but there is a whole bunch of foundational skills and activity and aptitude that you build up by taking on problem solving in the workplace with your coworkers that to begin with doesn't look like a strike. It can be pretty friendly. And then once you don't get the response you want, then you learn how to escalate and find a more compelling way to present your issues or to force the boss to consider the only way to deal with you is to deal with your issues. But at the same time, strike power, that threat of not getting the work done, is really the backbone of union power. So I'm wondering what you think the quit wave and the recognition in the public consciousness that workers run the world and without them, the bosses can't do anything, what this means for the existing unions in terms of turning back to not just strike power in terms of the all-out strike, but the control of labor, the control of your problems on the job as the baseline for labor militancy, which is not something that the labor peace goals of the National Labor Relations Act labor movement typically encourage. They, you know, encourage management rights and come to us when the contract's violated, but anything that falls short of that is, you know, what you have to deal with until we can bargain it away maybe later.
This is, in a sense, a kind of huge and complicated issue, but it can be simplified. I mean, first of all, you said the right word, which is escalation. And so any group of workers that are organizing, I would never suggest or urge that they go on strike tomorrow. It's slowly building your organizing and to build the trust and the capacity and the confidence to take actions, including escalating actions, which might eventually lead to a strike. And at that point, I would say also have supporters on the outside that can show up and help you on your picket line and set up a GoFundMe or some other strike fund. Like, there are pieces to put in place. And it does take some time, and it's worth taking the time, and it shouldn't be rushed. I mean, this is one reason I think you and I agree that calls for hashtag general strike are not really going to work, because that kind of trust building and capacity and confidence has not been built. Groups of coworkers need to work together over time to trust one another so that you don't just have one or two people walking out because they're probably going to get fired. You know, there's strength in numbers. So that, I think, is true. You mentioned about just, you know, regular union practice, you know, often kind of discourages this kind of activity. And on the one hand, yes. The way labor law has developed since the 1930s, the standard union practice usually has a union contract with a no strike clause. And, you know, workers have the ability to strike once the contract expires around bargaining time. It's not always that way. There are some exceptions, but that has been the general practice. There is a current of opinion, which I'm sympathetic to, which is that union contracts should not have no strike clauses. There is no reason to have them. It's a little bit complicated legally, but I would say, sure, it would be great if more unions would ditch the no strike clauses and then strike whenever there are problems at work that need to be settled. Again, it's a little complicated legally, unfortunately, but workers that don't have a union contract or any officially recognized union don't have those issues at all. They can go on strike whenever they are ready. Again, it is not without risk. It is not legal to be fired, but believe it or not, the boss can replace you with scabs, with replacement labor. In fact, they can permanently replace you. That is legal. So that's why we have to be careful about this. Now, some folks might say, what's the difference between being fired or permanently replaced? Well, not much, although there is a legal distinction. But I think the reason why we're talking about this as a possibility is that this year, when workers are quitting and bosses seem to be desperate for workers, there's more leverage on the worker side. Bosses will have a harder time finding scab replacements. So, you know, we would talk it through and we would see if specific groups of workers have the leverage that we think they might have. And then we can take action. But yeah, I know you raised a bunch of issues. And so I think that there's the regular kind of organizing that unions do, and then there's this kind of other kind of organizing. And I think any group of workers, I think we should start certainly with the solidarity unionism kind of organizing of just getting a committee and organizing. And then later on, they can make the decision if they want to go a more formal route.
With the question of the no strike clause and strikes, there is a lot of terrain that, or there's a lot of opportunities for worker power to be exercised that are obscured by that language, because there's so much that workers can do to control the labor process that don't involve walking out that also are typically excluded under these no strike clauses, including slowdowns and any other type of way of interfering with the production process, which are in those no strike clauses because bosses know that the all out strike is not the only way that workers can mess with them. And at the same time, there is this tremendous pressure on workers to keep up with sped up demands that they should be able to work within what is comfortable for them, effectively slowing down the production line as a just a self-preservation method, but then it's also a source of power for getting the boss to change things, especially when it comes to staffing levels and safety or health concerns that are directly tied to those.
Yeah, you're exactly right. We should not talk about the strike as the only thing workers can do. You know, oftentimes we look at strikes because they're big and dramatic, but there are other things that workers can do. Sometimes it might make sense for workers to stay on the job and do, as you say, there are things like slowdowns or work to rule. And, you know, work to rule are interesting because basically, you know, there is often a thick handbook of regulations and rules that workers have to officially have to follow. But then unofficially, they're asked to cut corners and speed things up. So a work to rule is, you know, workers collectively, ideally it's everybody or a majority, decide you're going to take your time and follow every rule. And then, of course, like things slow down and you're not as productive. And so there are those kinds of on-the-job tactics. And it may not even be clear to the boss, like, what exactly is going on. And if they kind of figure out and people seem like they're working slowly, then you can just say, look, I'm following the rule book. So you can see that there are other possibilities than walking out. And of course, if you stay on the job and organize in that way, you're getting paid and the risk is less. So I think there are these kind of on-the-job tactics. Other examples are workers simply deciding to do a thing. So for instance, you know, it's been a big thing over the last year with Black Lives Matter about whether workers are able to wear like a BLM support pin, or, you know, in other cases, whether workers can wear pronoun pins. Oftentimes employers don't want workers to do this. So instead of workers signing a petition asking if they can do it, they can all decide they're going to put on pronoun pins. And then the employer, so they basically have done it. And then the employer has to decide, okay, do I want to make an issue about this? Seems like everyone's wearing pins now. And sometimes they'll let it go. They might ask about it, et cetera, et cetera. They might let it go because it's not worth fighting about. And then the workers have set a new standard on the job. Maybe it's small. Now they have pronoun pins and they didn't have them before, but they didn't ask. They just did it. So I think that there's many possibilities for things like that, where if like you can get 3/4 or more of the workers to do a thing, the employer might just give up on it and let it happen, right?
I'd like to end on that note, making the boss just accept our terms of working for them. I've been talking with Eric Dernbach, a labor activist, an educator, member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and a organizer, educator with the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee. Thanks so much, Eric, for coming on and, you know, talking through these things and helping us clarify, you know, what we need to be focusing on.
Yeah, it's been great, Joe. Thank you.
Well, before I go, I'd like to share a poem. Listen, worker, I'm the boss. If you don't make me money, then you're gonna get tossed. What I pay you is what you get, so take your mind off of all of my profit. Listen, tenant, we don't agree. This ain't your home, it's my property, and I will milk it for what it's worth and kick them out who can't keep up. Back off, landlord, don't bully me. Us tenants got solidarity. We got a union that'll go on strike for every new goddamn rent hike. Fellow workers, hear me sing about the power to change everything. Without labor, without rent, all the bosses are impotent. When the day comes and we see our special power in the economy, we will seize the great machine and finally live, finally free.
That bit of music was from a song called All I Wanna Say by Michael Jackson. Before that, Joe Clement and Eric Dernbach spoke about today's very interesting moment in the labor movement. The entire interview will be posted later today on the KBOO website. You'll be able to find it at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Goods are in poor supply these days. You might have noticed this when your microwave oven broke down and it took you 4 months to replace it. Or you tried to repaint your bathroom and couldn't find any paint. But the current crisis in the supply of goods is related to much more than consumer inconvenience. To close out our show today, I'd like to read excerpts from an article by longtime labor activist and scholar Kim Moody, who argues that while just-in-time supply chains have been a boon to big business, they have contributed to rising prices, the squeezing of labor, and delays in the delivery of critical goods. The article, entitled Why It's High Time to Move On from Just-in-Time Supply Chains, was published October 14, 2021, in The Guardian. Kim Moody was a founder of Labor Notes in the U.S. and the author of several books on labor and politics. His most recent is called On New Terrain: How Capital is Reshaping the Battleground of Class War. This reading is lightly edited for length and clarity. A price shock on the global natural gas markets brings down several small energy providers, leaving customers without heating and facing rising fuel prices. A fire knocks out the huge cable sending electricity from France to the UK, threatening homes with darkness and increasing power bills. The container ship Ever Given, bound for Felixstowe from Malaysia, gets stuck in the Suez Canal for 6 days, backing up shipping traffic at an estimated cost of £730 million, which is very nearly $1 trillion, and delaying that electronic gadget you ordered from Amazon Prime. What these incidents have in common is the speed at which a single event can disrupt the supply chains that crisscross the world. Almost every time you order something online, it is transported via a network of factories, rails, roads, ships, warehouses, and delivery drivers that together form the global economy's circulatory system. This tightly calibrated infrastructure is designed for perpetual motion. Once one link breaks or stalls, the impact on today's just-in-time supply chains can be felt immediately. Just-in-time was the idea of Taichi Ono, an engineer at Toyota in the 1950s who was inspired by the work of Henry Ford. Ono defined it as a way of eliminating quote-unquote waste, by which he meant stockpiles, extra workers, and unused minutes in the production and movement of goods, instead of wasting time, labor, and money by storing parts along the assembly line or warehousing goods, as manufacturers had done for decades. Ono's idea was that suppliers could instead deliver these just as they were needed. In turn, this would increase profits, reducing the amount that businesses spent on maintaining inventories and paying for additional labor. After its introduction to the West in the 1980s, the just-in-time model gradually moved out of the car plant and into every type of goods and service production. It forced its way down every supply chain until each supplier, big or small, was expected to deliver products promptly to the next buyer. This increased competition between companies to deliver goods quickly, which meant firms reduced their costs, usually the price of labor. Just-in-time delivery thus contributed to the growth of low-wage, often more precarious jobs, with workers recruited only when they would be needed. This constant squeezing of workers has fueled our 24/7 work culture and the mental health problems that go with it, while attempts to cut the price of labor have added to the growth of economic inequality, regardless of who sits in government. Delivering products at speed relies on infrastructure. From the 1980s onwards, motorways widened, ports deepened, and extra runways were added here and there to keep up with the pace of change. 21st century warehouses transformed from places of storage into vast distribution and fulfillment centers. But speed, as any Formula One driver will tell you, brings its own risks. Floods, power outages, closed roads, labor disputes, and of course pandemics can all halt the system. Because just-in-time has eradicated stockpiles, an unforeseen crisis can lead to treacherous shortages. At the start of the pandemic, there were widespread shortages of PPE, gowns, masks, and plastic gloves, all of which rely on just-in-time production. Now, our just-in-time world is becoming increasingly crisis-prone. The schedules of container shipping have been unreliable since the pandemic began in early 2020. The rise of fuel prices has also led to reduced shipping speeds, known as slow steaming, to cut costs. Across Great Britain as well as the U.S., there is a shortage of land transport. In other words, dockers or warehouse workers have gone down with COVID, and truck drivers are in short supply owing to the pandemic, as well as years of stagnant wages, long hours, and lack of available training. Too few drivers means clogged ports, stalled ships, empty shelves, and higher prices. Supply chain managers and logistics experts are aware of all the potential problems, and for the past decade have been debating the trade-off between risk versus resilience, the latter being the ability to minimize or quickly recover from a disruption. Low just-in-time inventories increase the risks of shortages when a crisis bites. Resilience, however, means bigger stockpiles, more workers, multiple suppliers, and higher costs. This creates a dilemma. Competition makes resilience itself risky for individual companies. Who wants to buy from the higher-priced laggard? Yet, so long as profitability is the driving force, national efforts to turn inward or take back control simply create more disruptions, broken supply chains, and higher prices as businesses seek to recover losses. The regime of cheap consumer goods becomes more and more difficult to sustain. There are even bigger implications for this regime of breakneck capitalism. All this global real-time motion is driven by fossil fuels that are driving climate breakdown. The increase in tsunamis, wildfires, floods, and other extreme weather events is making supply chains and the necessities they deliver even more vulnerable. Climate change protesters are on to something. One way or another, if you deprive big business of the free use of its favorite deadly energy sources, you can slow things down to a human pace and maybe even save the planet while you're at it. Decades of deregulation, privatization, and market worship have left society vulnerable to the unbidden force of just-in-time supply chains. No amount of government subsidies, lower taxes, job training, and other shopworn policies will be enough to address the crises we face, from the pandemic to climate breakdown, which are causing supply chains to fail. Now is the time to think about not just how we make and consume things, but also how we move them. I've been reading from an article by Kim Moody, which appeared in The Guardian on October 14, 2021. Later today, you'll be able to find a link to the original article on our webpage for the show at kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour. That concludes our show for today. I want to thank Moles Bill Resnick, Larry Bolden, and Joe Clement for their contributions, and editing mole John Nelson. A big thanks to our guests, Norman Solomon and Eric Dernbach, and our unending gratitude to the tireless staff of KBOO. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. KBOO needs your support. If you can, please donate to keep community radio on the air in Portland. It's as easy as going to kboo.fm and clicking on the donate button on the homepage. As we speak, world leaders are meeting in Glasgow for the UN-sponsored climate summit COP26. Help put pressure on the delegates by joining multiple actions scheduled locally during the coming 2 weeks, including a rally next Saturday, November 6th at 4:30 p.m. You can check out all the actions planned by going to orclimatehub.org. You can also find daily updates on Instagram at COP26_PDX. All the links you need to keep you involved will be posted on our webpage for this show, which you can find at kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour. I'm going to leave you with one more musical clip this morning, this one by Michael Franti and Spearhead, called We Don't Stop, which is about resisting all the ways war is waged against us. Thanks for listening. Catch us again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. Until then, stay safe and stay active.
A war for gold, a war for money, and a war for souls. A war on terror, a war on drugs, a war on kindness, a war on hugs. A war on birds and a war on bees. They got a war on hippies trying to save the trees. A war with jets and a war with missiles. A war with high-seated government officials. Wall Street war on high finance. A war on people who just love to dance. A war on music, a war on speech. A war on teachers and the things they teach. A war for the last 500 years. War's just messing up the atmosphere. A war on Muslims, a war on Jews, a war on Christians and Hindus. A whole lot of people saying kill them all.